The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition, where today we're going to chat a little bit with Jim about some of the new and interesting things he may have found out from the latest Ed Slott Advisor Program conference that he went to in Dallas, Texas. So I am here with Jim. He's relatively recently back from Dallas. I think he had a pretty good time down there, sounds like.
Heard some interesting new things.
It was a good time, as it always is. It's one of the better conferences I go to, and we're finally getting CE credit for it. So kudos to Ed for finally getting into the 20th. Century, we're in 21st
now, but yeah.
But for years, I've been writing in the book, the evaluation form, ways to improve, and not only me, other people. CE credits, please, CE credits, because no other conference I go to is so focused on education as this one, with good in-depth delivery. I've been to a lot of conferences that all revolve around CE credits and education, but a lot of the courses just fail to live up to the hype that is listed in the brochure describing them. But the Ed Slott group, I really like it because everyone works well together and we learn a lot. There's a lot of sharing of the microphone and walking around the room, and everybody is talking, and Ed and the other advisors, he's got three consultants, he calls them, will all answer our questions, and it becomes this massive group discussion of 400 people. So I really like it. And finally, we're getting CE credits for the CFP, which was good. If I'm going to go all the way out there and spend all that time and money, it's nice we can finally get a little bit of CE credits for a course that I actually learned something at. Most of the courses you go to grab a CE credit, you know this, you leave thinking, really? I got credits for this? some CE credit programs.
Well, they don't measure your knowledge before you enter and then after you enter. So there probably are people who learn a lot from those, but once you get advanced enough in the career, there's always a little tidbit, I think, even in a poor, and I wouldn't call it poor, it's well-delivered usually. Most of the conferences that I go to, the speakers are quite excellent, but they go over so many basic things, you've heard them 1,000 times, but they usually have one little nugget that you either reminded of or is actually a new piece of information. So, but it is pretty tedious to sit through an hour or hour and a half presentation to pull out a 30-second tidbit, but, it is what it is.
So some of the topics that will find their way on to the Retirement and IRA Show that we reviewed, one that I really liked was a deep down drill in to ABLE accounts and special needs trusts. Oh. And if you don't know what an ABLE account is, keep listening. You will find out. And I really liked that one. I found very interesting. I ended up knowing more about ABLE accounts than I gave myself credits for. As they were reviewing everything, I always test myself in my mind to see if I know. And I knew a lot, but I actually learned a lot about those accounts as well. I'll also share with you a rather spirited discussion by one of the advisors in the room on his disgust of ABLE accounts. And he shared with us why he doesn't like them. And I vehemently disagree with him. And rare for me, I actually kept my mouth shut and did not mention why I disagree, because, and I'll explain why, because it was passionate for him from a personal standpoint. And I know I'm just giving a few little tidbits and not getting deep into it, but ABLE accounts and special needs trusts will be one of the topics that we'll get into, because we did spend a lot of time going over that. We're also going to bring back a fan favorite. Don't look at me that way.
I'm always nervous about new surprises during the recording.
Remember years ago when the Retirement and IRA Show was still a radio show and wasn't dedicated solely to podcasting?
Yeah.
What did we used to play when I would come back with you and Devin?
The tax decisions. So the tax rulings from tax court, and you'd describe PLR, the situation, yep. The PLRs, and then you'd ask us how we thought that they ruled.
That
was kind of a weird nerdy game, but yeah, we're bringing that back.
It was
kind of fun.
We're bringing that back, folks, because we spent a lot of time on a bunch of tax court rulings and PLRs. A lot of them revolving still around 60-day rollovers and the mistakes people make. Mm-hmm. And a few of them were just unbelievable. You got to hear the cases of what people actually... I don't know if the people actually believe the claims they're making and why they shouldn't be taxed and penalized, or if they're just trying to... They know they're wrong, and they're just trying to buy time.
You're right, yeah.
So what it is, I forget the name of what we used to call that. But what we did is I would come back from the Ed Slot group, because Ed used to spend a lot more time on PLRs, and PLRs is private letter rulings, if people don't know that. It's where you go to the IRS if you've made a mistake with something. Or feel the IRS made a mistake, or your advisor made a mistake. In other words,
you're about to do something, and you want them to tell you.
You apply for what is called a private letter ruling, and you have to make your case. It's a very involved. You just don't call them up and say your point and ask them, what do you guys think? You actually have to write it all out. You have to give references to the IRC tax code and why you feel your reasoning is sound. And then you ask the IRS for their opinion. Now, PLRs are not cheap. They vary in cost from about $5,000 all the way up to $20,000. It's crazy how much it costs to get a PLR. And that doesn't even count the cost of a good tax attorney or a good CPA to actually research and help you come up with the parts of the IRC code that you want to reference. Just don't make your case. You got to defend your case. So Ed used to always review PLRs with us. It was a whole walkout section. It was just PLRs. And he kind of stopped doing that, but he's getting back into it. Or he just was getting a kick out of these cases as well. A court case is different. That's where the IRS has already tried, convicted you, and sentenced you. And you're saying, no, I disagree. I'm not paying this tax. And you go to court, which is your right. There's been some interesting tax court cases. That's where I think people are buying more time. You're not going to pay $20,000 for a PLR to buy time. But you will haul the IRS to court, because it'll buy you another year or so before it gets through the whole process.
Right.
Just some of the court cases of what people were arguing. I don't know how judges can rule with a straight face. But anyways, I found it interesting. And not all of the court cases were so blatantly where you're just going to laugh and say guilty. Some are going to make you think. So what we used to do, folks, is years ago when we were a radio show at the local radio station, they gave us or wanted us to use one of their DJs kind of as a layperson on the show. And Chris and I used to joke that if they kind of turned their head and you know, like a puppy turns their head and puffs up their ears. Well, if the DJ kind of turned their head, and both of them were female, we had kind of puffed up their ears under their hair, we knew they weren't quite understanding it, like a puppy's confused on something and they turn their head. We would joke about Devin and, don't tell me the other one, Amy.
Yeah, nice.
Devin, yeah, pulled that out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And they were nice. I liked having them on. Well, it was fun playing this game because Chris would come at this with knowledge and Devin would just guess out of thin air. And a lot of times she beat you.
I know. Yeah, that's. I'm sure you find that hilarious.
I did. Because Chris would overthink it.
Yeah.
And would really explain his rationalization. And Devin would just be, I like the name Mary better than this name. That's why I'm siding with her. I mean, it was just, it reminded me, I'm a huge Cheers fan. And one of the episodes of Cheers is where they had a football pool going.
Oh.
And Diane kept winning right. the football
yeah.
pool.
Yeah.
Not because she right. was astute with football. Right. But the one that I remember was yeah. the Bears were playing the Dolphins.
Right.
And everyone was picking the Dolphins for right. some reason. I don't know right. why. But she said, oh, come on. A Bear would definitely beat a Dolphin in a
right.
fight.
Right. I know.
So back then, that was the equivalent. Devin was Diane and Chris was everyone else in the bar who was overthinking the game. So we're going to bring that back because we did spend a lot of time on that. I thought that that would be a really good thing to chat about. And one of the things we did talk about very briefly is something that we're going to talk about hopefully today on this show, and that is the TSP Modernization Act. But we're going to tie that into 401ks in this deep dive EDU show. But before we begin with that... And, oh, other topics that we're going to really get
not
into.
Not all on. Just to clarify, we're not doing all this today.
No.
This is just
kind of
a heads up
of what's coming. Yeah. We spent a lot of time digging into required minimum distributions again. And this is something that we kind of talk about every couple of years. And I want to dive deep into that, some of the topics. And reverse rollovers, which I thought, oh, there's a different thing we don't talk about all the time, moving money from an account into a 401k and the problems that can arise with that. So just interesting little topics. But the biggest takeaway that I want to chat with our listeners about isn't necessarily what I was taught at the Ed Slot program this segment. We meet twice a year, so this period. And we'll meet again where the hell is it? Baltimore. We're going to Baltimore next year in the springtime. I don't know what... Springtime in Baltimore. Is that going to be a pleasant trip or not? Well, it's Baltimore, so I don't know if it'll be a good trip at all.
Mid to late spring. I think early spring is still a little dicey, but...
Last week of April.
I think you'll be okay.
All right. We'll be at springtime in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And fall in Vegas.
Well, maybe cooled off a little. It'll only be 94 there.
And then the next two are in St. Louis, Missouri.
Both. To get a deal on a conference center or something?
Well, apparently, and I didn't realize this is something I learned, both of these were in Dallas this year. And normally, I always thought we were on the East Coast and then West Coast. Or east-leaning part of the country and west part of the country. And he finally shared with us their rationale or their reasoning. Once a year, they will do a left coast, right coast, and the next year they do a middle of the country for both.
Oh.
So they're trying to appeal to those who live in the middle of the country
mm-hmm.
and those who live on the outside coasts.
Got it.
So left coast, right coast, middle. Left coast, right coast, middle. This year was middle, two in Dallas. And then next year will be, what did I say?
Baltimore,
thank you.
Vegas.
Baltimore and Vegas. And then St. Louis. Hmm. So.
Nice.
No Denver. Apparently they did not like the distance from the airport to the city. They got a lot of bad reviews of.
Well, there's a ton of new conference center stuff out close to the airport now, so.
I wrote that in my.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that. Consider Denver again.
Right.
And let them know that there's a lot being built right next to the airport.
Yep.
Anyways, the most eye-opening discussions that I want to talk about, my big takeaways, and we're going to get into these topics on future shows, but today, it's discussions I had with other advisors. That was probably the most eye-opening thing. When I go to these events, listeners, and Chris, you'll concur with this, the lunches and breakfasts are almost like a wedding reception in the sense You walk into a big room, mm-hmm. round tables, usually hold about 10 to 12 people per table, mm-hmm. and buffet-style food.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a wedding reception.
Yeah. You grab your food, and then you make new friends.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's at those tables where a lot of discussions go. Everyone introduces themselves. Mm-hmm. Where are you from? And the conversation always evolves something like this, Chris. So what is it you do? What's your specialty? What is your business like? Mm-hmm. And people start sharing what they do and what their business is like and how they do things. And one of the discussions I had again, and it's something we have recently talked about with our listeners, is the number of advisors, and I'm shocked on this, and by advisors, I'm not talking financial planners, talking investment advisors, and how there is a difference between the two. But the number of advisors, Chris, who do not benchmark their investment performance for their clients. They just manage assets, but give the clients no way of measuring what they're doing. I had a rather interesting discussion with an advisor over that. During the lunch, as we're chatting, how assets are being managed was brought up. And how you charge for it, which is pretty big in our industry right now. How are you going to charge? And everyone at the table was the same, AUM, AUM, AUM. And for those who don't know, why don't you explain what that means?
Well, it stands for assets under management. So they charge you traditionally a fee, generally as a percentage of the assets that you've brought to them for them to, quote, manage for you. And that percentage is oftentimes on a sliding scale. I think it's more frequent than not that it's on some kind of sliding scale, meaning the more you bring over, the lower the percentage that they might charge you to manage your assets. So if you have a smaller account, the percentage is a little higher, I guess, to make it worth their while to mess with it until it gets bigger. But the industry, the advising industry, has been built kind of on that platform as far as investment advisors go. Brokers are technically something else. Brokers historically handle transactional things. They're not managing your assets. They're just handling the transactions, and they traditionally are paid on a commission for these transactions. But we're talking about investment advice under the investment advisory approach, and assets under management has been the way of the world for decades, and it's traditionally still done that way. Things are evolving. Not everyone does that approach anymore. Some of the big houses now are taking a very different approach to managing assets and charging for that management. But that's what AUM means, is they're going to charge you a fee, generally a percentage of the assets that you've brought under management. And the fee can vary wildly from the low, we call them 20 basis points or something like that, which is 0.2%. Up to, I've seen in excess of 2%. So, wide range.
The highest most corporate RIAs will allow is 2.25%.
Yeah.
And by a corporate RIA, folks, that means a registered investment advisory firm that often acts as a middleman for investment advisors, such as myself and other investment advisors. We can use their platform, we can use their services, their back office, their compliance, and they take a percentage of our income. They'll say, okay, you made this much, we're taking a certain percentage of it, and usually they take about 20 or 30 basis points, the industry calls it BIPs, which is essentially 20 or 30% of 1%. So you can kind of do the math and figure out how a lot of advisors pay. And that's called a corporate RIA. And most of them, from what I have seen, Chris, allow their representatives, investment advisor representatives, to charge up to 2.25%, which mm-hmm. I think is insanity. The industry standard is 1%. That's kind of the industry standard. Okay, so with that background, we're sitting around eating, chatting, everybody's sharing, and it's tying into investments and financial planning. And a lot of people are asking, do you do planning? Do you do planning? And a lot of the people at the table, some were business models similar to mine, where planning is centric, and that's what we do. And I shared with the group, that's all we do. We lead with planning. I wasn't winning too many fans at this table when I started talking. But I said, I lead with planning. That investment management, I said, for us, we offer it more as a convenience for our clients to make their lives easier. So we really control our fees and keep them low. And instead, we lead with planning. We allow our clients to price on an a la carte basis, choose the planning service that they want, and move forward from there. And that's kind of how I described it. Mm-hmm. And sitting to my left was a former wirehouse broker who now worked for a corporate RIA, but was trying to get out of the brokerage industry and into the planning industry. And then there was another gentleman sitting off who does investment management and led with that, said, we are more of an investment management-centric firm, but we are starting to offer more financial planning. Mm-hmm. And he said, we offer it for free within our investment management services. We don't charge like you do, pointing to me. And I said, that's fine. I mean, that's how most mm-hmm. people do it. Mm-hmm. And he also said, they're starting to offer financial planning as kind of an add-on to differentiate themselves from other firms. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I didn't, but I didn't want to burst the guy's bubble. You're not the first one doing this.
Right. A little late to the party.
I think he is, yeah. if you want my opinion. Yeah. And what are Chris and I getting at, listeners? Investment advisors. A lot of you who tell us, who call us for a coffee and a second opinion, most of you are a Vanguard do-it-yourselfers, but not all of you. And a lot of you indicate on our initial form we send you for a coffee and a second opinion phone call, we send out what we call a snapshot, which doesn't ask anything about your assets. I don't care how much you have in assets. Why don't we ask that?
Because it's not central to what we're doing here.
No.
It's a side, just one of the a la carte options that you might have.
Exactly. You don't need to have a firm manage your assets in order to get advice. So we don't ask anything about that. But one of the questions we do ask are you working with a financial planner? Yes or no. Mm-hmm. If so, what do you like about the relationship or what don't you like about the relationship? Mm-hmm. We ask that. It just kind of gives me a little background. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people who indicate they work for a financial advisor or a financial planner, but after talking to them, that advisor or planner are really nothing more than an investment advisor. And there's no financial planning being offered, and that's why people are calling us. They want planning, not necessarily investment advice. So I didn't want to burst the bubble of this other gentleman there, what you just said. You're kind of late to the party. A lot of investment advisors who are being questioned on their fees are throwing in, well, we're going to do financial planning.
There was, on that same vein, there was just a study released. I just saw it. Michael Kitsis quoted it, and I think it was a study by Cerulli, which is a research firm, and said that of financial advisors, so this you know umbrella term that we refer to people as financial advisors, that just over 50% claimed to do financial planning as part of being a financial advisor. Cerulli looked into it, and only 24% actually provide financial planning.
24 of the 50.
No, I think it's it wasn't clear of the okay. I didn't read the entire thing, but it sounded like only 24 out of 100, not 52 or whatever it was out of 100 that claimed to do it. They held themselves out as, "Oh, we do financial planning." Only when you peel back the you know, pull back the curtain, turns out they don't really do that. It's just they're using it as a leader, as to get people that are actually looking for that kind of help. Oh, no, come on in. We'll kind of do that. But, you know, the most important thing, the only thing we're going to talk about is investing your money.
And that's where this conversation I'm leading our listeners to. There is a point to what I'm getting at, folks. I'm just trying to set it up so you can understand how the industry works and what advisors actually talk about and do when we get together. So again, the gentleman who is doing predominantly, by his own admission, investment management, is starting to offer financial planning to his clients. Starting to offer. Keep that in mind, Chris. Starting to offer. So during the conversation that I was having with him, the conversation also got around to how do you manage portfolios, which is how most of financial planning conferences end up. So much of it, Chris, is all about investments. And it bugs the hell out of Chris and I because we do planning. We offer investment management, but we lead with planning. The industry leads with investment management and is starting to offer planning. But they're offering it the same reason this guy at the lunch table, this was a lunch meeting I had, not a breakfast meeting. At the lunch table, his firm is starting to offer it, as he told us. And as he worded it, Chris, he thought he was trying to differentiate himself from everyone else. I think he's late to the party because a lot of people are starting to offer, a lot of investment advisors offer what they call financial planning. And Chris and I will talk to you in a minute about how they do that. But they're trying to do it to stand out, I think, Chris, from a lot of people who are starting to realize we're not getting much of value from what we're paying for. So with that in mind, I said to the gentleman who manages money predominantly, and I didn't think the conversation was he was going to answer what he answered. I really didn't. I thought he was going to say something else. And I was trying to get, honestly, hopefully, some good feedback and thoughts. So I looked at him and I said, how do you benchmark your investment portfolios? Because here's a guy who said they're predominantly investment advisors. And I wanted to know how he benchmarks, because we are always looking in our office for ways to improve. I think the way we do it is very fair and reasonable. We use benchmarks from Morningstar, which are independent. We have no control over them. Morningstar offers 5 benchmarks from conservative, conservative growth, moderate, moderately aggressive, and aggressive. Now, we call it conservative growth. Morningstar calls it moderately conservative.
Right.
Gets a little confusing, so I say conservative growth. But conservative, moderately conservative, or conservative growth, moderate, moderately aggressive, and aggressive. Mm-hmm. So we use those benchmarks in our reporting software and will map client portfolios to that, both individually, and we offer an option if there's multiple portfolios where they can combine them into one and see them all, but always benchmarked to an appropriate benchmark based on what we agree at the time will be the level of risk the client is looking to assume. Put what's your portfolio objective and risk level? Okay, sounds reasonable. Mm-hmm. That's how I do it. I was expecting some feedback. Here's a firm a lot bigger than ours, asset-wise, not planning-wise. He did less than 10 plans a year. When I told him we'd do more than 50, that table shook. I mean, the whole table. More than 50. They're looking at me like I was making it up. I'm like, no, seriously, we do more than 50 plans a year. We are a planning firm. We're like the unicorn. People have heard about firms like us, but they don't really see them much. So I asked this guy, how do you benchmark? I know you know the answer, and I'm going to pause and let you get a word in edgewise, because normally it's the other way around. You just yap, but now I don't get a word in. So I'm going to let you get a word in. What did this guy say to me?
Well, I'm sure he said, we don't benchmark.
He did.
That's 80-90%. And you know, kind of let the cat out of the bag for me beforehand because you were so shocked at his response.
His answer.
That the reason for it is he doesn't want to be judged solely on investment performance. Let that sink in for a second. Here's somebody charging for investment advice, but doesn't want to be judged on that advice.
I mean, shocked.
It's okay. If you're giving them, a client appreciation dinner and gifts at birthdays and maybe one during the holiday and maybe a few, congratulations for your kids when they graduate from college cards or something, you're getting those types of things. And then you're going to say, well, that's really what they're getting for their fill in the blank percentage of AUM. At least be upfront and say that. Say that, you know, this is what you're getting from me, because the investment advice, I am not going to allow you to judge me on that actual job that you're paying me to do, because I think you shouldn't dismiss all this other frills maybe that you're getting on the side, which there's nothing wrong with frills. The problem I've always had with this whole thing for years is the lack of transparency. People don't realize what they're paying. They don't know what they're getting in exchange for what they're paying. And if they knew that a bunch of it was these frills, in a lot of cases, I'm making broad generalizations here. Not every firm is like this. But if they're not going to divulge to you truly how their investment advice quality was and be able to independently, comparing to a third source, be able to show you the results of that advice, I think it's like saying, you know, pay me to paint my house, but don't judge the work. You know, don't look at the other houses that have been painted. You know, just look at the way I painted your house, and there could be paint all over the windows and the wrong color on the trim and all this kind of stuff. And, of course, if you look at another house, you're going to compare it and you're going to complain. Imagine a painter saying, no, you can't look at anything else. We're not going to compare to anything. We're not going to compare to any standard way of painting. You're going to judge me just on what I did. Well, how, you don't have context for any of that. How, there's no way just in the back of your mind, you know, oh, he did a good job investment management. That's such a, it's difficult to just have a natural feel for what the number should be. And there aren't people really that have that. The only way, this whole investment advice issue, when we judge the quality of investment advice, the bottom line is, did that advice pay off? Was there an advantage gained from getting this professional advice? Because there is a cost to it. If there's no advantage you can point to, if there's not enough of an advantage, then it doesn't justify the cost.
Exactly.
Period. Not that investment advice should be costless. I'm not saying that at all. But to put it out there and then just take the stance, you can't judge me on it, I'm not going to give you anything with which you can judge me, you just want people to be in the dark. That's what you're saying. You want people to stay ignorant so that you can continue doing what you're doing.
And that's where this is going. And I actually liked the guy, and that's why I'm not going to mention his name, his company. He actually was a really nice guy. I just disagree with the model, and he's been in the industry a lot longer than I have, and I've been in 21 years. And he is steeped in the way it used to be. Mm-hmm. Again, here's someone
who's, a lot of people are,
who's just offering financial planning now to differentiate himself. And again, I didn't say anything, but I was thinking the exact same thing you said. I was like, dude, I'm thinking in my mind, dude, you're like 5-8 years behind the eight ball here. A lot of people are offering alleged financial planning, but they're just doing asset management. You're not differentiating yourself.
You're becoming one of them. Yeah.
But look at what he admitted. He's only doing about 10 financial plans a year. He was asking, how do you do plants? Because he's looking to increase the amount of plants, get his clients to do more plans with him, and I think justify his fee. I'm guessing. I don't know. But when I asked him, how do you benchmark, I was expecting to hear, oh, we use this software program or this, and we come just, you know, we have multiple benchmarks, whatever. I was hoping to learn. And what I learned was he's no different than everyone else. Remember, about a year ago, I shared with this our listeners another conversation, also at the EdSlot meeting, with a person who said he doesn't benchmark. I always remember this answer, because it avoids difficult conversations. That's essentially admitting, I'm not coming anywhere near the benchmark, so if I just don't benchmark and keep my clients in the dark, it avoids a difficult conversation. So I said to that advisor, but how do you say to your clients, you know, here's what you did and we achieved whatever it is you're trying to achieve if you're not benchmarking it? He said, easy. We tell clients this gentleman did a lot more planning than the other one. He said, in their plan, we have a rate of return that our clients are trying to achieve. And as long as we're coming near that return, we tell our clients, doesn't matter what the market's doing.
You're on track on the plan.
You're on track on the plan. Mm-hmm. Well, that rate of return was between 4 and 5%, depending on the client. And I'm not bemoaning that rate of return. If his clients are similar to ours, and I don't know if they were, most of our clients are pre- and post-retirees looking for a moderate portfolio. Right now, our forward-looking return projections of a moderate portfolio are 5%. So I think that's reasonable, his approach. But he said, we encourage our clients not to look at what the market is doing, look at what we're trying to achieve. I think that's a little more defendable than the other person at the EdSlot meeting recently, who just doesn't benchmark at all.
Yeah. I guess I'll just have to point out, because obviously when we talk about this return, it's not that you're going to get that return every year, although in the plan, that's generally how it's modeled. There's some other approaches related to Monte Carlo that deal with it a little differently, but most planning software, we put in an assumed rate of return. That's assumed to be the average, so some years you might get more, some years you might get less. So I guess if they're in a given year or period, they're less than the plan average, they'll just have to remind them, oh, remember, yeah, last year we were above, so we're still tracking okay. Or maybe they track an average over time. That'll get a little dicey if you get some volatility, real, you know, high or low returns in the early years of a plan. Your average isn't going to be the plan average, so things are a little bit weird. But, you know, at least that is, if you think about it, it's almost like the assumed rate in the plan becomes the benchmark. Mm-hmm. That becomes the standard by which you are measured.
That's how that
advisor does it. But what it's ignoring, what's the concerning part here is it's not clearly expressing this balance that is most critical in understanding investment performance, which is the balance between return and risk. It doesn't divulge to them, are they in an appropriate risk level? So he'd hopefully have another conversation with
and
them about that part.
You must be reading my mind, because that's where I'm going with this, folks. On both these advisors, the conversation evolves, because it's a conversation we're having, and I brought up risk to both. Now, the gentleman who benchmarks to the expected return, or doesn't benchmark, but compares, there's no benchmark in his reports. He doesn't put a 5% in there and show where you are. He just compares. I asked, what about risk? Do you show your clients, if you're managing their portfolio, are you showing the clients how much risk they're assuming to get that return that you achieved for them, net of all your fees? No. There's not a discussion on that. They're trying to achieve a rate of return, he said, and they manage the portfolio for that rate of return.
The concern I would have in that case, then, if I were a client, the concern I would have And if you were asking me in my opinion about what you might go to that other planner and ask them, I would be concerned that they are worried about covering their fees, so they dial up the risk in your portfolio, hoping to goose the returns a bit, exposing you to potential loss. You know, when things pay off, when you take risk and you win, nobody complains, right? So if things happen to fall in their favor and they generate good returns, excess returns, and they harvest all these fees, and look, you're still getting your 4.5% net or whatever it is you were looking for, they claim success, but they've left you exposed to a bad year. You now are exposed to the downside, which then they're going to plead the case, please don't leave, please don't leave, because when you take a much more significant loss in your portfolio because they've got the risk knob turned up too high trying to cover their fees. That would be the concern I would have, is that they're not totally working on your side and following your direction, because they're not clearly having this discussion about the risk level of their portfolio.
Again, very good point. And there's Chris is going with this, folks, exactly what I was thinking. There's no script here between he and I. Chris and I are just having a conversation. You're thinking the same thing, because that advisor, the second advisor, the one that I just told you, not the one recently, but the second one, his fees were 2%.
But he does all this stuff under that, right? He justifies that via giving him plans and all, and
he does
birthday
more
cakes
planning,
and all that kind of stuff.
But what I'm getting at is, if his expected return is 4 to 6, he has to gross 6 to 7. And to net out to the clients,
six
4 to 6.
Yeah.
4 to 5, rather. No, 4 to 5. So it would be 6 to 7 he has to get. He does a lot of work with individual equities. He doesn't do a lot of work with funds. And he did say that keeps his costs low for his clients.
On one side of it.
Right.
We talked about fees and
but,
the costs.
Right.
Yeah.
But he still needs, in my simple math, to be earning more than what the clients probably might be thinking in their mind.
Yeah, when they think 4 to 6, they're thinking moderate. And he might have them in moderate aggressive in order to do
exactly
what I just mentioned, to cover those fees and to show them that they're still netting close to the plan, which in an up market, nobody complains, right? Nobody complains unless you're thinking about it more deeply, like I've mentioned. But they might be setting themselves up for a horrible year.
Well, I've asked them that. Now I'm going back to a conversation from last year, and I know I talked about this a year ago on this podcast. But when we addressed that, when I asked him about that, he said we look at the longer, it's more difficult, he admitted, for a new client.
Right.
But when a client's been with him for 5, 10, 15 years, this man's business is a lot older than mine, and my business is 17 years. So he says when we look at a longer-term client and the market is down big,
we point to the average.
Yes.
Yeah, they say Don't bother looking at that.
Right.
Look at this number over here.
Look at that.
Right.
Look at the long-term average.
Right.
We're doing what we need to do. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's not what we do.
There's an issue as their clients. He's taking an accumulation approach when they're heading into distribution with retirement, and he's opening them up to sequential risk issues.
I agree, and
so,
I don't think his firm... In fact, I know
probably
his firm
talk about that.
Is well, it's not a retirement centric firm like us.
Okay.
It's more of a generalized financial planning firm. Mm-hmm. Whereas ours is retirement centric, and we would never do that because we understand distribution and sequential risk and all of that. But back to the gentleman I just had this discussion with, who said he doesn't benchmark because he doesn't want to be measured on investment performance only. That shocked me because he's admitting he's an investment advisor. He's just adding financial planning. He didn't recently remove benchmarking.
Right, he's not been doing
it. He's never done it.
Right.
So when he was not really offering financial planning, what was his justification then? I'm being paid to manage your money, but I don't want to be measured by my performance. That's asinine. So I said to him, how can your clients, though, evaluate what you've done relative to the risk you're taking on? I said, I benchmark all my client portfolios. And I started getting into how we do it with Morningstar, and it depends. Clients have to have one of our five models, but we will benchmark the model to an independent third party. We use Morningstar. We input Morningstar's data right into their planning, into our reporting software, and clients will see the Morningstar benchmark and overlaid our portfolio. And he said to me, he said, what do you do when your performance doesn't keep pace with the benchmark? And I said, I go into this telling my clients it's not going to keep pace with the benchmark. We tell our clients that the benchmark is devoid of economic reality. Morningstar rebalances their benchmark monthly, paying no attention to taxation, to trading costs, custodial fees, or even advisory fees. They just rebalance the benchmark monthly, and that it's being provided as a baseline measure, we tell our clients. So you can be assured, if you want a, and I told them, our forward-looking return projection for our moderate portfolio is 5% right now, up from 4.65 in December of last year. That how we've increased it because of the big drop in the market in October, November, and December of last year. And right now it's 5%, and that could change at any time. But if a client wants a moderate portfolio, we can't adjust and invest them in a moderately aggressive or aggressive. I have to honor that. So we tell them that we use benchmarking to show them the correlation of their portfolio.
That it's actually behaving like a moderate,
should. And we say, and I knew he knew what we were talking about. So I said, so we show him the R-squared. And for those who don't know, why don't you explain what R-squared is? And I know we just talked about this, but in case they're new.
It gives us an indication of the correlation or how related two things are that you're comparing over time. So the movements, something with a high R-squared, a pair that you're comparing with a high R-squared will tend to be moving together rather than separate. The lower the R-squared number, the more independent they are from one another in their movements. So if you're trying to mimic, if you will, the benchmark or behave like the benchmark, you want your designed portfolio to be highly correlated to the benchmark portfolio. And the proof of that is when you measure the actual movements over time, the statistical measure that is referred to as R-squared is a very high number.
Right. And I tell them we strive, and we tell our clients we strive for 95 or higher in the R-squared.
And that's out of 100.
Out of 100. So if you're coming in at 95, 96, 97, 98% of the correlation to the benchmark, we are tracking the benchmark. And then we monitor our beta. Beta is, why don't you explain to listeners?
It's a level of risk. So that's the beta. It measures the degree of volatility or risk that the market is, that your portfolio has compared to the market itself. This is an appropriate measure to use when you're comparing diversified portfolios. So it's not something you generally, you wouldn't use to compare success or failure on an individual investment, an individual stock, for instance, or bond. But here we're talking about portfolios, and that's appropriate to look at the overall risk level. And the market itself, the average of the market, which isn't necessarily a moderate portfolio, by the way, but the market itself has a beta of 1.
But when...
go ahead.
I was just going to say, the software we use will take the beta of the benchmark and compare it to the portfolio.
So essentially what they're doing in that case is they're making the standard that you're comparing against, not the overall market, but the benchmark portfolio itself.
Exactly.
And if the risk level in the two are the same, the beta of your model portfolio would be 1.0 in that case.
Exactly.
If for some reason the beta of your portfolio comes up, that calculation comes up a 1.2, which it never, I mean, that would be a failure in your trying to match the risk level. That would imply that the risk level inside of your model portfolio is about 20% higher than the risk level of the benchmark that you're using. So usually, you know, beta is used in a lot of different ways. That term is thrown around here. This is a specific beta. When we talk about the big beta, or, you know, the more common beta overall, so if you've heard people talk about this before, they're talking about the beta in relationship to the overall market itself. But just for clarification, what Jim is referring
and
to here is
any advisor has
measuring.
Access to mm-hmm. this software.
And this is a calculation that can be easily done
right.
with software.
It can be easily yeah. done. If you, and that's what I'm getting at, guys, listeners, if your advisor, if you're working with one, isn't doing this for you, it's a business decision they made. And I'm just sharing some of the reasons why advisors who don't benchmark, don't benchmark. These are the guys who don't benchmark and telling me why they don't benchmark. And I don't care. Their reasons are essentially, we don't want to be measured. Mm-hmm. Because they know probably deep down, they're not giving what the industry calls advisor alpha. Alpha is the term advisor alpha is supposedly the benefits of using an advisor. What are you going to get from using an advisor?
If the advisor is claiming they can generate that for you, there's other reasons advisors give you advice. It isn't necessarily to generate alpha. It might be to replicate something that you can't invest directly in, like one of these model portfolios or the benchmarks.
Exactly.
That's one way. But oftentimes the prestige or sexiness of the investment advice world has always been the claim that an intelligent, hardworking advisor can create this advisor alpha for you. In other words, generate for you returns that are in excess of what you would normally receive taking the level of risk that you do with this advisor. The advisor's advice is superior to just investing passively at a certain risk level. They're able to pick winners and losers and provide advice, and you benefit from that ability of them to pick winners and losers. Very, very difficult to do. And there's always this big question that's been studied over and over and over again. If an advisor appears to have alpha, was it due to intelligence, hard work, whatever, or was it luck? And in most research shows that most of the time, it's luck. That shows this.
Well, so I will say a lot of investment advisors are sharing that the true alpha that they give, and this wasn't mentioned at the table, but a lot of investment-centric advisors say their alpha isn't necessarily better returns.
That, right?
It is the emotional right. management of their right. clients' passions or emotions. They don't let the emotions right. of the client rule.
They're going to call that advisor alpha. I agree with that, if you can keep them. But what they're really doing is preventing you
from
generating
decisions.
Negative alpha for yourself
right.
by making bad emotional decisions. Instead, you know, being more rational in your decision making. If they can help you do that, it reduces your personal negative alpha. If they want to call that positive advisor alpha, I guess I could bite that. I could swallow that.
And Vanguard, you Vanguardians, actually came out with a study on this probably, God, it's got to be 6, 8, 10 years ago now. But if you Google Vanguard Advisor Alpha or something similar to that, they did a study and came up with 5 or 6 benefits of using an advisor mm-hmm. and actually claimed that the advisor can add something like 3 or 4 basis points to a return. And they broke down how that is calculated. If you get that report and actually look at it, most of the this is an older report. Most of the reasons that they've listed have been surpassed by technology. Mm-hmm. And there's only one left now, and it's that emotional.
The behavioral thing.
It mm-hmm. was rebalancing and a few other things that, yes, years ago were difficult to do. I have that study. I don't have it handy. I've read it many times. And I'm an advisor. What I laugh at on it is it's either four of the five or five of the six. I can't remember if there's five or six elements in Van Gogh's study. If you really look at it objectively, listeners, and you advisors who are listening to this podcast, most of them have been replaced by technology. And the only true one now is that keep people from making bad decisions. My point that I wanted to say to this guy, and I didn't, even though I can be very opinionated, as you know, I'm not looking for arguments at these events. And I actually sit there and don't, surprisingly, me, don't say much unless pushed or asked. And I just kind of listen a lot. But a lot of these investment-only advisors, and Chris and I have a problem with them. We don't like the AUM model. And we're children of the AUM model. We grew up in that. We left it when we started capping our fee and approaching asset management the way it should be approached. If Vanguard's study was touted by the investment advisory industry, you don't hear them touting it much anymore.
Right.
Touted of why you want to work with us. Look at that study and you will see either four of the five or five of the six, in my humble opinion, have been replaced by technology and no longer necessarily need that human right. advisor and the associated fees. If really all's what they're doing is keeping you from making a bad decision by calming you down in a bad market, I would argue, number one, we haven't had a damn bad market for 11 years. So you're paying for something that you really haven't used. But also, that to me is the true advisor alpha, but need not be charged, Chris, at 1% of assets.
Right.
Because here's my issue with that. And I didn't take this up with that guy. I just was shocked. I must have had this gaping look when he said, I don't want to be measured by investment performance. Now, y'all might be sitting there. Did you say to him, Jim, what do you want to be measured by? Yes, that was my question. I didn't share that part with you. So I said to him, what do you want to be measured by? And he said, I want to be measured by all the services I offer my clients. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's why he's trying to get into financial planning. I asked him, what else do you offer or do? Mm-hmm. He says, well, we're getting into planning and we're going to do planning.
Yep.
Do you do taxes? No. Do you do tax planning, preparation? No. Do you see where this is? It just, how do you even question that? I mean, I didn't want to start an argument. And then he said to me, how do you do it as the investment as a planning centric. And I told them we price a la carte. We let our clients choose the services they want. We try to give a flat price as often as we can. That's when I mentioned I did 50 plans and everyone at the table's jaw dropped. And one person even said, did you say 50? I said, yeah, 50. We do about 50 plans a year, probably more. Do you really? I mean, I don't know. I don't count. I know we do
it's
a lot.
More now.
God, this year alone, this week rather alone, I delivered five.
It's more now. Yeah, it's more.
Whatever.
Set it up.
Which is fine.
Right.
That's what we do.
That's what we want to do.
Exactly. Yeah. And then he asked, how do you approach then investment management? And I already shared a little bit about what I was saying. And I led them on and I told them, and this is where most people probably officially thought I am crazy.
Mm-hmm. Anybody faint?
When I told them we cap our fee at $3,000 to manage a portfolio. And that in our opinion, the use of an advisor is driven more for convenience than for alpha. Now, I didn't get into the Vanguard study and how, in my opinion, four of the five or five of the six, I got to get that study out again and look at it, have been replaced by technology. And really, we're offering convenience. We're doing the paperwork. We do the conversions. We'll do the distributions. We do the due diligence. We make sure that they're following a benchmark closely. And then I told them, we always tell our clients, you're not going to beat the benchmark. It's impossible. The benchmark is devoid of economic reality. It's rebalanced monthly. I already said all this. I understand that. But it's rebalanced monthly. It pays no taxes, no trading costs, no management fees, custodial fees, or advisory fees. How the hell are you going to beat that? Because you have to pay taxes, custodial fees, trading fees, management fees, and advisory fees. Instead, what we try to do is charge a fair price. We manage a very disciplined model. Half, I said, is in total passive Vanguard Admiral Share index funds. The other half, and we'll be moving that around a little and embracing some ETFs and things I told them. I said the other half is actively managed, but not by us. We use actively managed, publicly traded, open-ended funds. Those are the funds that will be the beta measure. I'll get into it. So we look at the funds by risk. Those are funds, and any advisor listening to this knows, allocation funds only come in three flavors, conservative, moderate, and aggressive. And I didn't really get into this at the table because they know all that already. I forget that our listeners are not advisors. But what Chris and I do, listeners on, well, we don't. We hire people. We have investment people who work for us. What they do is they look at the active funds from a beta measure and make sure those funds are not taking on more risk than what their prospectus indicates their investment aim is. Conservative, moderate, or aggressive. We use no aggressive ones because we haven't found any we like. And I explained that at the table. I don't think they heard any of that because they were freaking out over how I capped my fee at $3,000. One person even said to me, so somebody comes with $2 million, you're going to manage it for $3,000. I said, absolutely. If they believe in our approach and understand they're going to be in one of our five models, half will be passively managed, low cost, earmarked totally to the Vanguard benchmark. What we actually do for the passive side is we take the actual, for those who don't know, and again, most of you won't know because you don't do this or you have advisors who don't do this, Vanguard tracks 18 asset classes. Those 18 asset classes make up their benchmark.
Morningstar. You said Vanguard.
Oh, I'm sorry. Morningstar tracks eight.
Morningstar isn't a Vanguard replacement. Morningstar is a research firm that collects all this data and does all these reporting, provides these benchmarks.
I'm sorry. If I said Vanguard, I misspoke.
It's okay.
Morningstar tracks 18 asset classes. We'll divide the asset classes out under their opinion. Morningstar's, I don't want to call them advisors. They're more CFAs
analysts
and deep investment guys. They come up with what they feel a conservative growth, moderately aggressive, and aggressive portfolio should have from an asset allocation side. You can divine the risk by creating that, and that's what we did. We created that portfolio using index holdings, low-cost index holdings to match what Vanguard does. Now, whatever. All 18 asset classes are not represented in each benchmark. Some benchmarks have some, others don't, obviously. Right. So on our passive side, and I did share this with the table, I said, this is how we do it. And I said, come on, guys. With trading software, you know this isn't that hard anymore. I said, I have a staff that does this. Their job is to track what Morningstar's doing with their benchmark, make appropriate changes. I said, in fact, to keep our clients' trading costs low, when Morningstar makes a change, and they generally do once a year, sometimes more, but generally once a year in the summer, we evaluate first, Chris, is it worth making that change? Is it going to add anything? What is Morningstar's old benchmark and new benchmark look like? So we can make sure that trade is worth it. If it's not worth it, we won't make that change yet. We'll wait and change it later because we like to rebalance on an annual basis and not have to rebalance more and incur additional costs. Why? Every cost to a client is what?
Reduction of what they right. get to keep.
Less out. And I tell them, we don't need to trade to justify what we're doing. Unlike a lot of investment advisors who have to say, oh, hey, this was a busy quarter. I did 14 trades in your portfolio this quarter. So people sit there going, oh, my God, wow, this guy's great. He's really looking out for this. No, he's trying to justify his existence. So we instead will try to keep costs low, I shared with them. And then I said on the active side, our job is to do our due diligence on those actively managed funds to make sure from a risk standpoint, they're not straying from what their prospectus says they're going to do. And that's I told them. I said it's a very scalable offering and that's how we do it. They were freaking out. They were flipped out. They didn't understand. And that's when someone, I always remember this part, someone who didn't come to that lunch, sat down while we were talking, didn't hear that we are a planning-centric firm. And he said to me, and you do planning on top of that for $3,000? I said, no. It's just a separate service. Everyone has to pay for our plans. Okay, so that gives you a little. Why am I mentioning all this? Recently, Chris, this week, I had a coffee and a second opinion meeting. And I also delivered a plan. I'm not going to mention who these people are. I'm not even going to mention their state. Neither one of them are from Colorado. So that limits you to 49 other states to choose from. Both of them are working with existing advisors.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, very nice couple, found themselves in a situation where they have $1 million in annuities. And they're questioning if that was a wise thing to do. I don't know yet if it was, I told them, because we haven't crunched any numbers. But they do listen to our podcast, and they're starting to realize a lot of the illiquidity of those annuities might keep them from spending on fun things.
Early on, when they're young and healthy enough right. to do so.
Mm-hmm. Because these are annuities that are not income annuities directly. They're annuities whose income benefit have to be taken as withdrawals from the portfolio.
And they're limited in size.
Right. And I don't want to get into that because I just got a text from Pete. He's actually waiting for me at lunch. So I got to run. Apparently, I'm supposed to meet Pete for lunch. And Pete is the attorney we usually bring on. Anyways, this person shared with me, we're coming to you because we just need help determining if these annuities are okay. And the last person we talked to wouldn't answer that question and said they couldn't. And I asked them, why? And they said, because in order to work with them, we have to actually move our $1 million to them.
So they wouldn't even talk to them unless they did that.
And then they would charge us a fee to manage it, and then they would answer it.
Oh, how convenient.
I couldn't believe that. And I says, well, we're... That's not us. And in defense of that company, they said, do not move this money from the annuity because you would have to pay a penalty.
Yeah.
So they were very upfront. We're not a good fit for you. We have to manage your money to give you advice. Your money is in an annuity. You can't remove it. So we can't give you advice. That, to me, it's a business model that's very common. But it's not our model. But I also want to borrow on a person who we did deliver a plan to. And when we do a plan, it is not an investment review. It's a financial plan. So we do a cursory review of a client's portfolio. During that cursory review, Scott was looking at the... He saw fees being debited from the client accounts on the statements.
Mm-hmm.
So Scott has a PhD in finance. The guy can figure things out. And he came to me and he says, it looks to me like they're paying 0.9% to have their assets managed. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I'll mention that to them. So I did mention that to him, that it looks to us. And they said to me, wow, we didn't think it was that high. I always thought it was 0.6. And I said, well, it very well may be. We don't have the account opening documents. But right now, Scott did feel, based on the debits, it was 0.9. We don't know. I said, you should ask. Mm-hmm. And then I said to him, you appear to have a moderate portfolio. And I said, that's because you have about half in stocks and half in bonds. And out of the half in bonds, 15% was cash, 35% was bonds. I said, that seems to be a moderate portfolio. You have all of your bonds in IRAs and all of your stocks in a Roth IRA. I have no problem with that. You want the heavy growth. You want the more mm-hmm. fixed income in the IRA. I'm fine with that. I said, have you or does your advisor combine those two portfolios and benchmark the performance of those two? Because you really can't look at the Roth as one and the IRA as one. Mm-hmm. It's really how the two of them are. Because when you see nearly 100, it's not quite 100, it was 90-something percent equities in the Roth and 100% bonds and cash in the IRA, that's not an accident. That is by design. So it's telling me they probably have a moderate or conservative growth. Scott said, hey, this could be conservative growth at 50-50. The client, the people I delivered the report for, they're not our clients. They have other people who are managing their assets. They weren't sure what the goal was. That's my point. And the advisory firm never combined and benchmarked it to something for them to look at. And I said to them, you should ask them for that, because how else can you make sure what they're doing is first worth the fee? You should also determine what that fee is, truly, if you're paying it, not only in percentage terms, but in dollar terms. And the reason is this, folks. 0.9% doesn't sound like much. 1% doesn't sound like much. But if your return is 4, 5, 6%, and they're taking 1, don't look at it as 1% of your assets. Look at it as maybe 25%, 20, 15% of your return. And are they, in my opinion, adding enough value where they're taking a quarter or 20% or 15%, whatever it comes to, of your return?
Right. Because if the portfolio they've designed generates 5 and they take 1, they're taking 20% of your return. People, they advertise it as this little measly 1% number. But they're taking 20% of what the portfolio made for you that year. Talk about a drag on the portfolio.
And that's where benchmarking comes in, because benchmarking doesn't show fees. The benchmark doesn't have a fee coming out of it. So you can look at the return the benchmark did and the return your portfolio did, and then decide everything in between that is listen to our show on fees. Represents trading fees, custodial fees, advisory fees, platform fees, investment management fees of the actual investments the advisor is using if they're not using individual stocks and bonds. And it gives you a chance of saying, that was worth it. Or, hey, is there something we can do? This gentleman did say, I'm going to chat with my advisor. And I said, you might want to ask them if they'll even lower the fee for you. He said, I'll ask them. I haven't heard if he did or not. But I share that with listeners, because if you are using someone, and we're not against that model, We're not all pro our model. Our model is unique, yes. If you had $2 million and we were managing it and we capped our fee at 3,000, yeah, you're paying, what is that, 15 basis points. But we don't measure it by that. Our job is to be convenience. It's a convenience fee, essentially. We'll do all the due diligence. We'll do all the paperwork, all the RMDs, all the filing, all of this, and make sure your portfolio is doing what you want. But we don't hide from the benchmarks. We embrace it. Hey, let's look at what the benchmark did. Now, the only difficulty with that, and I maybe a lot of advisors don't like to benchmark because of this, benchmarks also show no money coming in and out. And when you start taking money in and out, you can have a lot of divergence. And we're going to bring Scott on the next EDU show to explain why that happens, why you can get divergence from your benchmark in your portfolio when you start adding cash flow. Mm-hmm. He'll come in and chat about that. But we got to wrap up today because Pete's wondering where the hell I am.
For sure. You're probably late.
I'm wicked late.
You're wicked late.
I'm going to blame it on you.
So with all that, and he gave you kind of a recap or a heads up about the new topics we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks on the EDU show. So a lot of good stuff coming out of the Ed Slott program again. And we want to remind everybody today that we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners. Do a little investment advisory work on the side, but mostly financial planners with the niche retirement planning. Right. And if you're interested in talking to us a little bit more about what we can do for you and your retirement situation, please reach out to us at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form you can fill out, and we'll get right back to you. Or you can, actually, there's a handy-dandy little app on there. You can schedule open slots in the calendar. That isn't all the open slots, so if you don't see something that works for you, we will get back to you on that contact form. That's probably the best way to reach out. And we really appreciate everybody listening today, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show. Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.